if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
The display persisted, and then we knew that the spacecraft was entering Saturn's atmosphere. This was on Friday early morning, and we watched the signal as that little peak disappeared.
What's it like to work for NASA? And what if, in the course of your career there, you had the opportunity to spend 13 years on a landmark mission that would explore Saturn as no other spacecraft had ever done? That is the experience David Doody had. Dave is a senior engineer at Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Lab, and he served as the lead spaceflight operations engineer on the Cassini-Huygens mission. Dave, who has now worked for NASA for 3 decades, is the lead author on their free tutorial on spaceflight, which is available online. In addition, he teaches an annual class at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena on the basics of spaceflight. I had the opportunity to interview Dave live at San Gabriel Valley Pride's 16th Pride Festival on October 14th of 2017 in Pasadena Central Park. Join us now for our conversation and the questions our audience asked. Can you take me back in your imagination to the days in Teaneck, New Jersey, growing up, and tell me what first sparked your imagination, what first attracted you to spaceflight?
Wow, what first attracted me to spaceflight? Was looking in a small telescope that my father had got for me and my sister and set up and showed us Saturn and Jupiter in the evening sky. And there was Jupiter with 4 little moons all lined up in a row, and there was Saturn. This is when I was 4 or 5 years old in Teaneck, New Jersey. I remember it as if it were a week ago. And Saturn, which is just a jewel, it's unbelievably neat in the sky. That's a word that's used too much lately, but you just can hardly believe how neat those rings look. And in fact, by the way, tonight I'll be on Colorado Boulevard offering free views of a telescope through a small telescope of Saturn. So that charged me up about space. And my father and my grandfather, my mother's father, got together and built a rocket ship in the backyard, made of plywood and 2x4s, and the thing stood 16 feet tall, and it offered 2 floors for space enthusiasts, young astronauts. This is the 1950s. There was no such thing as space travel of any kind until 1958, when the Russians did it. And so here was this thing in the backyard, painted silver with aluminum paint. We had to drink lots of tomato juice to get tomato juice cans to be the rocket engines down below the thing. I never did drink enough tomato juice to make that actually happen. But my friends in the neighborhood and I would put on our space helmets and fly throughout the solar system. Fast forward decades, and I get the enormous privilege to join the Voyager mission, which was at that time leaving Saturn, going to the next planet, Uranus, and I joined the team as an engineer, left that for another one, the Magellan spacecraft, which orbited Venus, did the same thing, real-time operations, flying the thing. And then when that was over, I joined the Cassini mission and been doing that ever since. And I often think back to that first rocket ship.
The 2-story rocket ship. How amazing that has to have been.
Yeah, and the Cassini spacecraft was actually a little bit larger than that.
That's kind of neat to think about by comparison here. Mm-hmm. You became aware of Cassini. You got on board with the Cassini mission, mm-hmm. which I understand did some things nobody had ever done before. Mm-hmm. What's an average day like when that's your job, is to be the lead for a mission that's doing something that's never been done before? Mm-hmm.
Well, the average day was meetings and emails and emails and meetings and more meetings and more emails. But the fun part was going out and and talking about the mission and describing it and showing slides or pictures about everything that's been happening. It's been an enormous privilege.
What were some of the scientific findings of Cassini that might even have surprised you?
Well, some of the scientific findings, and I'm not a scientist, I'm an engineer, but I work with scientists and enjoy what they've been doing with the Cassini spacecraft, which, by the way, the engineers design and build and fly the spacecraft for the scientists. The scientists are, quote, on board with their cameras and spectrometers. They have us point different directions, if it's possible, if it's safe to point that way. We never point towards the sun. And in doing so, over 13 years orbiting Saturn, some of the discoveries were most amazing. One of them, a little moon, only 500 kilometers in diameter, had geysers of water streaming out of the South Pole. Too small to really be geologically active. That was a big surprise for the scientists and for the engineers when the scientists said, let's fly through the plume. Fly through the geyser of water and stuff coming out and use the instruments to detect what it was made of. And turns out it's mostly water, it's salt water, it's got a lot of organic chemicals in it. And there's ammonia, there's even free hydrogen, which they say, and I'll believe them, portends volcanic events at the floor of the ocean that's under this little icy surface.
I don't think of an ocean as existing in space. That's amazing.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, and so these are enormous surprises.
That really is. What will that mean for future spaceflight?
Future spaceflight is already being planned. We've got to go back to that little moon. It's called Enceladus. And if you forget the name, just think enchiladas and pronounce it a little differently. Also Titan. Titan was a moon 10 times as large, is a moon, and we'll see it tonight from the street. It's 5,000 kilometers in diameter and has an atmosphere thicker than Earth's that's hazy so that you can't see through the haze and clouds to the surface. So the scientists equipped the Cassini spacecraft with radar and infrared sensors that could penetrate the haze and clouds and see the surface, where we found rivers and lakes and seas on the surface. It looked very much like the coast of California.
Wow, the coast of California.
And so those beckon. We've got to go back. Someone from the Earth, most likely an international mission, a lot of international cooperation makes these things happen, will return to maybe float in the seas, fly a blimp in the atmosphere of Titan, and fly through, maybe even land on the little moon Enceladus with its geysers.
Enceladus. I'm going to have to remember that name. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard it before now. If you were to design a dream mission that you could do right now, build a spacecraft, maybe going back to Enceladus or wherever else, what would you be doing? What would you design?
Oh, gee, what a question. A dream machine. Well, you know, the whole Cassini mission from design, it took about 10 years to design, a few years to build, to launch with a launch vehicle, fly for 7 years to get out to Saturn, and then orbit Saturn doing the science for 13 more years, cost roughly the same as one B-2 bomber.
And how much is a B-2 bomber?
Well, B-2 bomber, I think, goes for around $2 billion. Cassini is around $3 billion U.S. dollars, although there was a lot of contribution from the Europeans. So I would double it. I would shrink the size of all the engineering components, because having launched in 1997 and having to use proven technology, the computers were big, the memory was huge and heavy, the instruments were large and bulky. Nowadays, you're filming me with a new technology, we can certainly shrink the size and mass of anything that goes back to investigate the Saturn system, or the Jupiter system, for that matter. There is a big push. There's a project being designed, the design is being finalized now, to go to Jupiter and investigate a little icy moon about the size of our own moon, Europa, which, again, has an ocean of salt water below the icy surface.
I never knew anything about that until just now. Is that what you will be doing in the future? Will you be doing the investigation of Europa? Or are you
I don't know what the future holds. The immediate future is to help clean up, do the documentation that's necessary. Being on the engineering side, I get to help with the non-science archives of data and sweep the floors and close out the lights. That'll take a few months.
Last engineer, I'll turn off the lights.
Yeah,
is that what
yeah,
I just heard?
Yeah.
What will be one of your absolute favorite stories and absolute favorite memories from the final? We saw this dramatic plunge with Cassini when it was over, from the final days of Cassini.
Oh, the final days of Cassini was watching the signal from Cassini on a big display in the mission control room up at JPL. The shape of it looked very, very much like the typeface character Curly Brace. You know, the little brace with a peak in the middle, and then if you lay it on its side, and the little peak represented the signal having crossed interplanetary space for an hour and a half and arrived at the Deep Space Network's antennas in Australia and was sent immediately to that display in JPL. The display persisted, and then we knew it was time that the spacecraft was entering Saturn's atmosphere. This was on Friday, early morning, September 15th. And we watched the signal as that little peak disappeared. It returned very briefly, which meant the spacecraft was turning and its main antenna signal was gone off of the Earth. It was not pointing precisely to the Earth. But as it continued to turn, and it turned against its will, if you will, because of the atmospheric drag that it was never designed for. As it turned, a little blip returned to the display, which meant that a side lobe, in radio talk, was passing through the Earth, and then it was gone forever. A little signal that we had appreciated seeing every day for 20 years, then it was gone.
That has to be an incredible adjustment. I've heard people even talk about Cassini like it was a person, like it had died or something.
Yeah, it's easy to anthropomorphize, hey, I spit that word out, okay, a big robot. But I think I've avoided doing that because I know what it looked like when it was in pieces all over the floor in the spacecraft assembly building. It was all connected and we were getting the same kind of signal. And then after launch, it was no longer connected to us by wires, but it was connected to us by that little peak of a signal that we saw, and that continued. So I continue to imagine it as lots of computers and technical hardware.
Floating through the space and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
What if somebody listening right now in our current audience here would really like to work for JPL and they're not quite sure of the climate from the LGBT community? What advice might you give them?
I would advise if anybody wants to get into the space business, whether it's JPL or other places, just love what you're doing, follow your nose, and don't take no for an answer. That's what I did. Having formed a desire to learn about space, even fly through space when I was a kid. When I learned about the Voyager missions, having actually taken off with cameras on them to go out to Jupiter and Saturn and then eventually Uranus and Neptune, you couldn't keep me away. I met the right people and I kept calling them and pounding on the door, and they hired me just to shut me up. They're all different fields. Engineering, science, technical support, administrative support, any discipline, as long as you love what you want to do and try to apply it to something exciting like a space flight.
Did you become aware of the Cassini mission? Were you hired on right after Magellan, or was it something you said, I really love to do this? How'd that happen for you?
As Magellan was ending, and I was the one who sent the command that caused Magellan to go into Venus's atmosphere and burn up, after we had extracted every bit of data, scientific data, out of it. I knew people who were moving to the bigger project, the Cassini project, and I did the same, I guess. Here we go. I wanted to work on it, and so along with another friend or two, I went out and bought a Saturn automobile, thinking that driving a Saturn might help me catch the eye of people on the mission to Saturn. It worked.
I was going to say, what a PR trick here. Uh-huh. So somebody saw your cool car and they said, oh, you want to work on this mission to Saturn?
Well, no, I developed enough leverage over the years to actually be heard. But yeah, I did that.
Let's talk about the skills that somebody, you've said, don't give up. You want to do something, you've got to be persistent. Mm-hmm. What are some of the main skills right now that anybody listening might have to cultivate to be what you're looking for?
I think if you just make a list of all skills, you can apply it. Good administration, technical knowledge, circuits, electrical engineering, chemical engineering, physical, mechanical engineering, and that's only the engineering side. Telecommunications, of course. Then there's the whole science side. What is a solar system? That's a scientific question. To me, I think that's the most amazing part of it. We're seeing what it's like to live in a solar system. We've investigated Venus and Mercury and Earth a bit. We've investigated Mars. We've got things crawling all over Mars. We've investigated Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and now Pluto. And we're learning what a solar system is, what it means to live on a planet, what a planet is that orbits a star and how that forms, which personally to me boils down to, it's just amazing that existence itself exists, that a star was born out of other older star stuff and formed these planets where we find ourselves awake and talking to one another.
I'm back on that little moon with the salt water. That's blowing my mind because you've said a lot of things that I never even thought of.
Yeah, what's in that ocean?
Our conversation. Mm-hmm. We haven't said one word about your book yet.
Oh,
okay. You were the main writer of the tutorial, if I'm remembering the name correctly, Deep Space.
Deep Space Craft. The publisher is Springer, and it's more of a textbook. It shows all the technical details about everything really connected with an interplanetary flight. The other one is Basics of Spaceflight. It's a little bit less technical, but it covers the whole ground in less detail. And it's more of a high school level, I think, interest. It's a snapshot of a website that I built at JPL, and it's jpl.nasa.gov/basics. And the other book is just a snapshot of that in time. It was 2011 when we printed this. And it's a good handy reference if you want to know where's Enceladus. How do you get there? How do you communicate with a spacecraft to go there?
jpl.nasa.gov/basics.
That's right.
Is what people need to check out. I understand you also teach a course, and we're getting a good little bit of interest with people looking at your books. You teach a course over at the Art Center in Pasadena?
Once a year.
And that would be spaceflight as well. How did you come to make that choice for an art class?
Oh, boy, what a great question. Well, obviously, I'm enthusiastic about traveling in space with robots. I don't have too much interest in putting humans in Earth orbit just to chase around 100 miles above Earth. But interplanetary travel, boy, that is so exciting. We're seeing new planets, new worlds, with new eyes, infrared eyes, ultraviolet eyes, seeing in the radio waves, encountering all this. Why shouldn't an art college be interested in that? That was my question to the administrator at Art Center when I had the privilege, just the great chance that she was touring Mission Control on one day, and I happened to be assigned to lead her through Mission Control, and we got talking, and we agreed that, yeah, we should try setting up a seminar, and it's open to the public once a year at Art Center College of Design.
And when do you have sign-ups for your class?
They are during the summer, and so registration usually opens in May, and it should open again this coming May.
An art student comes into your class. And let's assume this is a person who daydreamed through science class. They saw nothing that had to do with them in science. What's one of the first things you're going to teach that person to capture his or her imagination?
Well, what brought them to the class? Why were they interested in anything spacey? And by the end of the seven Thursday nights, we'll have covered things that, not in a whole lot of technical detail, because there isn't time, and most of the students don't want to get into all the math and technical stuff, but we'll get a sense of how it works, an intuitive gut-level feeling of how you communicate, how a spacecraft has to turn and fly, what path it has to fly, according to Isaac Newton. And so maybe a filmmaker will learn that, oh, I can't make my spacecraft move that way. I have to follow the laws of reality and make it move this way. And communications, art students, filmmakers, animators, and also the general public, who's ranged from homemakers to surgeons to celebrities. Once every couple of years, we'll have a celebrity who's interested. And so it's just the range of whatever they're interested in.
What might a filmmaker not know about how a spacecraft can turn and fly? What mistake might they make?
Well, the classic example of that, I think, is Star Wars. You see the spacecraft moving just like an airplane would move, even though there's no atmosphere for it to use for leverage to make its turn. Things happen according to orbital mechanics, not according to aerodynamics. And it's a different look and feel. I'm not that current on science fiction, so I can't mention a spacecraft that does it well, although I have seen many now recently. But, for example, you might see a complicated-looking spacecraft, not aerodynamically sleek, but just as complicated, with antennas and sensors bristling all over, because there is no atmosphere to worry about. You might see it move in what looks like a straight line, and then rotate, fire a rocket thruster for a few seconds, and then begin to move in a slightly different direction.
And of course, that never occurred to me either, because watching Star Wars, you just tend to accept.
And things that we see flying around here on our planet follow rules of aerodynamics.
I get the impression that you're still learning and still loving what you're learning every day in science. What's one of the coolest things you've learned in the past 6 months or so about space?
Oh, boy. Well, I've mentioned Enceladus and Titan, the moons of Saturn. Well, I guess one of the most cool things I've learned about space is the other moon back at Jupiter, which is only 5 times as distant from the Sun as the Earth is. Well, Saturn is 10 times that far. Little moon Europa, with its saltwater ocean, which was pretty well confirmed by the Galileo spacecraft a couple decades ago, the Hubble Space Telescope has been pushing the limits of its detectors looking at Europa and finding that there's pretty good evidence of a plume of water being ejected, sort of like Enceladus's plumes. It's not 100% confirmed, but it pretty well looks like it's there. So if Europa's ocean is also offering freak samples, just come and get some. You don't have to dig through the ice to get to the ocean. I think that's a really cool find.
That really is. Before we turn this over to our audience for questions, if they'd like to, there's a standard question I usually ask my guests here on Over Coffee, which is, what would you really love people to get from you and your work at JPL about innovation, creativity, and making a difference?
Gee, I don't know, Dot. I think maybe the excitement of how everything is possible in flying among the planets. For centuries, humans have dreamed of not only flying in the air, but traveling to the moon or those wandering dots in the sky. And now, today, it's possible. And I think just the excitement of knowing that it's possible, and perhaps that one might be able to join in the project.
I got to ask, you mentioned having your spaceship in the 1950s. Were you one of the kids that stayed up practically all night to see the moon landing?
Oh, absolutely. But I wasn't a kid. My partner Donald and I were living in Fairfield. We were in the Air Force. Donald and I met in the Air Force. And in our little apartment in Fairfield, California, we watched a little black and white TV, for hours and hours and hours while Armstrong and Aldrin set their craft down, waited forever. In real time, it just looked like it took forever for them to decide to get out, but we watched them get out and set foot on the moon. I guess that was staying up late.
I guess that was. I can still get shivers because I remember seeing that back east as well. Before they start all the drums and everything over here, my goodness.
Is that Shiwei with his drums?
I would love to know if our audience have any questions or anything. Anybody have any questions? Yes, please.
What happened to the rocket that my parents built?
Yeah.
You know, now that there's Google Earth, every once in a while I will look at that yard. It's still there. The yard is still there. The rocket, there's no trace of it. We moved away when my father got a job in California. And, gee, what year was that? It was maybe a couple of years after the rocket was built. So it's not there now. I don't know whether any other kids got to move into a house with a rocket ship.
What an incredibly cool thing for any kid. Any other questions? Yes, please.
I have a question. Does scientific people get afraid? The scientific people get afraid when they see something unusual on space?
Do scientific people get afraid when they see something unusual in space?
Yes, when they see something they were not expected.
Yeah, great question. Well, again, not scientist, but an engineer, but scientific type. I'll take that label. I don't think there's anything that has frightened me except for the realization that a big meteor might come and hit us, but that's just thinking about it. It's not seeing something. I love to see a meteor when it comes through the atmosphere. Events like eclipses or just looking at Saturn in the sky, they're not normal. They are exciting. But I wouldn't say scary. Would you?
Just think about it. My heart is like, but then I'm like, let's not think about that. I've come there.
Maybe a big flare on the sun. That would be scary.
Thank you. Great question. Any further questions?
What are your thoughts on the work that Elon Musk is doing along with SpaceX and traveling or creating rockets to potentially go to Mars?
Yeah, Elon Musk wanting people to go to Mars. I love the fact that he's developed these very efficient rockets that put their payloads into orbit and then return to the Earth and get to be reused all over again. I think that's marvelous. And a lot of interplanetary projects are depending on Musk's SpaceX rockets to launch, to get their boost to interplanetary space. As far as putting humans there, personally, I differ with a lot of colleagues. I think we need to learn more about how to take care of a planet better before we go inhabit a planet, not knowing what might be living in an ecosystem maybe 10 feet under the soil. We just don't know yet. So I'm not all that excited about hopping on Elon Musk's spaceship and going there. I would rather wait a few decades, learn more about what's already living, if there is anything living on Mars, and then proceed carefully accordingly. But he's going to send people. It'll be an exciting thing to set up an expedition on the surface of Mars. I won't oppose it.
This will be an exciting thing to explore. Any further questions from anybody here? Before we wrap up, I would love to know, first of all, you say you're going to be out on Colorado Boulevard with your telescope. Where and when tonight, if people want to check that out?
Well, since it's a clear night, it's a warm day today. A clear day and warm, and Saturn is visible in the south. I will be on the north side of Colorado, somewhere in Old Town, wherever I can find a parking space. So probably between, between Raymond and Pasadena Avenue on the north side of Colorado, as soon as it gets dark.
So people should check that out. And any online resources or links where you'd like them to contact you and find out more about your books?
The books, just go to Amazon, look for my name.
go to Amazon. Yeah. And let's give that JPL tutorial link one more time. /basics, is that right?
Yeah, the URL for that is jpl.nasa.gov/basics.
This has been great. And I promised you there was one question I was going to be sure and ask you, because you told me you'd be disappointed if I didn't ask it.
Oh.
Dave, why are you a vegan?
I think it's amazing that life exists on Earth, or anywhere. It might exist elsewhere, but we don't know. And while we're here, being part of life on Earth, let's be kind to other things that are living, instead of just assuming we can raise them and kill them and eat them.
Dave, thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you, Dot.
You and I have been listening to David Duty, senior engineer at Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Lab and lead spaceflight operations engineer on the landmark Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn. NASA's free tutorial, of which Dave was the lead author, is available online at solarsystem.nasa.gov/basics. Once again, that is solarsystem.nasa.gov/basics. And if you'd like to know more about Dave's Basics of Interplanetary Flight class, which he teaches every summer at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, check out their website. As Dave says, registration information should be up May of next year. Past students of Dave's course have said things like, one of the best classes they've ever taken, a lot of fun, and they didn't want to see it end. Art Center College of Design's website is artcenter.edu. Once again, artcenter.edu. Information on Dave's class and registration for it should be available in May of 2018. Meanwhile, congratulations to San Gabriel Valley Pride on a fantastic 16th Pride Festival. San Gabriel Valley Pride bills themselves as a different kind of pride. Every year they put on a community and family-oriented Pride Festival at which everybody is welcome. If you'd like to know more, and by the way, admission is free, you'll find information and volunteer opportunities on sgvpride.org. That's sgvpride.org. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to Over Coffee at twomavericks.com. That's two, T-W-O, Mavericks, M-A-V-E-R-I-X, twomavericks.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.